Many years ago, Riley Knight completed a degree in history. This proved to be a bad move, as it was absolutely useless for him. Until now, here's some half-assed history.
What's going on, mate? Great to have you along for some more half-assed history. This week on the agenda, going to be having a chat about the infamous sky pirate D.B. Cooper. On the 24th of November 1971, an anonymous man skydived out the back of a passenger plane with $200,000 in his back pocket, and he was never caught, and to this day, no one knows what happened to him. It is an incredible story. It's one of the greatest unsolved mysteries in recent years, and we're going to get across it right here and right now. So as I say, the story begins in 1971, specifically on Wednesday, the 24th of November. This is just before Thanksgiving in the United States. And a bloke walks into the airport in Portland, in Oregon, and he's just carrying a briefcase with him, and he buys a one-way ticket from Portland to Seattle, down in Washington? Is Washington further? Washington's further north than Portland. I guess it doesn't. I mean, north is just a concept we made up. So up, down, left, right, sideways, backwards. Who cares? Anyway, he's flying from Portland to Oregon. That's the takeaway. That's the headline. That's what we're focusing on here. And he buys this ticket with an airline called Northwest Orient, right? So an airline that has three of the cardinal directions in it. It's got north and it's got west, and then apparently Orient as well. The only direction they don't fly is south. Anyway, he jumps on the plane. And he sticks a dart in his helmet. He's munching away on a durry because, of course, in those days you could smoke on a plane. So he's loving it. He lights up a death stick and he's having a great time. And then he orders himself a bevy as well from the in-flight, the cabin attendant there. He gets himself a bourbon and soda. Right now, the plane, it's a Boeing 727, and it takes off on time at 10 to 3, so at 2:50 p.m. up and away. Wheels up, I believe they say in the airline. I don't know that for a fact. Most of my knowledge of the airline industry is based on watching Air Force Proud's videos on YouTube, so I'm very ready to be wrong about that. Anyway, the flight attendant, her name is Florence Schaffner, right? Now, she's strapped down for takeoff near him. Obviously, you know, they sit down on those little jump seats, whatever else, and get strapped in. So she's doing that. And while she sat waiting, or during the takeoff, he hands her a note, right? So this bloke, he gave his name, actually. We don't know his real name. He gave his name as Dan Cooper when he bought the airline ticket. He's a very, very well-dressed bloke, good-looking fella, wearing a dark suit. He's got a tie. He's got a little tie pin on. So, you know this bloke. He ain't playing. We know that. Anyway, he hands Schaffner this note. Now, she doesn't even look at it. She doesn't even look at it because she assumes that this bloke's been a bit of a sleazy bastard, to be honest. She assumes that, you know, it's his number or an invitation out to dinner and drinks, whatever else. So she's like, look, mate, I'm not interested in that. You got Buckley's chance, mate. You got no chance at all here. She's not about it. Anyway, he insists that she reads it, right? So she does, sure enough. He whispers that he's got a bomb on the plane and that she should read the note if she knows what's good for it. And so she goes, oh, geez, all right, this bloke's not mucking around. And so she opens up the note and reads it. It has, you know, the instructions that are contained inside it. Sure enough, he is threatening to blow up the plane with a bomb unless they comply with his demands. So Schaffner sits down next to him, and he actually asks to imagine. Look at this! What are you, fairly bloody gutsy move from this chick here. So, you know, this bloke, he said, oh, I've got a bomb. She's like, I don't believe you. I want to see it, mate. So she sits down next to him. And he opens up the briefcase, and sure enough, inside this briefcase, there are 8 red cylinders, and connected, they're all connected with wires. I presume, you know, curly wires, just like it's something out of Looney Tunes. You know, geez, it sounds ridiculous, but apparently that's how it goes. Anyway, Cooper, if that's his real name, we're just going to call him Cooper. Cooper turns around and says, "Listen, mate, I want $200. $200,000. I want $200,000 in cash, quick, smart, and let's." Take a quick break here. It's important to remember $200,000 in 1971 is worth almost $1.2 million today. This is all American dollars, by the way. $1.2 million. So, you know, this is not peanuts that he's asking for. And in addition to that, he says, I want 4 parachutes and I want for the aeroplane to be refueled as soon as we land in Seattle. So he wants his money, he wants his parachutes, and he wants the plane to be refueled the moment that it touches down in Washington. So she goes off to the pilot. Schaffner, she gets up and goes off to the pilot to explain the situation, obviously not wanting to cause a panic amongst the rest of the passengers, wanting to keep them calm. And then, anyway, so she has a chat with the pilot, comes back. Anyway, this bloke, you know what he's doing? He's popped sunglasses on. He's like bloody Samuel L. Jackson in a Poker Stars commercial. He's popped his sunglasses on. He's too cool for school, this bloke. And The pilot now obviously has to make a decision about what's going to happen. This pilot, his name is William Scott, and he gets in touch with the airport in Seattle, and they obviously inform the cops, the authorities, and everything else like that. And everyone else as well who's included in this is the boss of Northwest Orient. His name is Donald Nyrop, which, to be honest, sounds like a made-up name, but, you know, that's apparently his name there. So Mr. Nyrop, he orders his employees to cooperate with the hijack. He doesn't want to put any lives at risk here. And obviously the FBI are on the case straight away. So they go around to different banks, the FBI, and they go around to different banks in Seattle and get they actually get this cash together. They get together the $200,000 at a very short notice, and they photograph every single note that they're planning to deliver to this hijacker. They take a photo of every single one, so they've got all the serial numbers, the way that they look, the years that they were printed, all that sort of stuff is going into the archives. Now the passengers on board, they're not told what's going on, obviously, not wanting to create a panic. They're told that there's a minor technical difficulty as the plane goes in circles, essentially, for hours and hours, 2 hours. It is going in a holding pattern above Seattle Airport because the flight was only actually supposed to be half an hour. It's not such a long flight between Portland and Seattle, but they're stuck up there because, again, of this minor technical difficulty. So the next time you get told that when you're on a plane, well, maybe you should be crapping your dacks, because who knows what's going on. Anyway, Schaffner, she's on hijack duty. She's on hijacker watch. So she hangs out with Cooper, and apparently he's actually quite chatty. He points out stuff down below. He's looking at, you know, local landmarks, whatever else, through the window. And he's generally super chilled out, super cruisy, and being a pretty good bloke. He actually even tries to tip Schaffner after ordering a second bourbon. But again, she's not about that. Not interested in his money, not interested in his number, nothing like that. Get out of town. You know, not, you're a dirty rat bag. You're trying to hijack the plane. Don't want your money. Take it, you know, stick it right up your bum. Anyway, the flight finally lands when the FBI have got everything together at 5:24 p.m. 5:24. So there's no bloody Ryanair fanfare this time when the plane lands 2 hours delayed. Anyway, Cooper tells the pilot to park her up on the tarmac where it was isolated and well lit. So he's not pulling all the way to the terminal building, just going to park her up on the tarmac there like that. A Northwest Orient bloke named Al Lee brings out the cash and the parachutes, just as he demanded, and three fueling trucks are being used to fill the train. The plane, the big flying metal cigar, as full as a gook. So trying to get it to, obviously, you know, nice and refit. Don't want any funny business. They just want, they want to fulfill this this hijacker's demands, what, you know, to make sure everyone's going to be safe. Anyway, Cooper then, after this all happens, Cooper then goes, he lets everyone exit, he lets everyone get off the plane, except for some of the crew, who he then chats with and tells them what the plan's is. He says, all right, fellas, get your heads together. I'll let you know what's going to happen here. Cooper wants them to fly all the way down to Mexico City at the slowest possible speed and the lowest possible altitude. So he's wanting to fly low and very slow all the way down to Mexico City. The co-pilot, William Ratichak, he says there's no way we've got enough fuel to get all the way there, especially at that speed. Even after, you know, we would have to basically make another refueling stop to do that. And so they actually agree to do this in Reno, in Nevada, which, actually, extremely mildly interesting. This is a very, very mildly interesting fact about Reno, Nevada. It is further west than LA. Despite being in Nevada and LA being in California, Nevada is actually further west than Los Angeles. I don't know if that's of any interest to you, but now you know it, and hopefully you won't forget it. It will be one of those things that just lodges. So, you know, you can delete old Spice Girls lyrics out of your brain and replace it with that. Anyway, Cooper tells them to take off with the back staircase open. Now, this is a very odd request to make, because obviously the pilots, they're not happy about this at all. They're saying it's not possible. Imagine taking off in a plane with a staircase open. In this case, because it's a 727, the staircase is right at the back, right at the arse end of the plane, so you'd be coming right out the back of it if you walk down the stairs there. But the pilots are just like, we can't do it. We can't do it. It's not safe. We'll crash. We'll burn and die. And Cooper, he doesn't argue. He's like, all right, you know your eggs. We're not going to do it. That's fine. He says, I'll just open it myself. Don't even worry about it. You know, I'll take care of it. So at 7:40 p.m., so it's been sat there for a while now, but they're ready to go again. 7:40, the plane is back in the air, and this time on it is just Cooper and four of the crew. There's Scott and Ratichak, the captain, the co-pilot and pilot, and then a flight engineer, Anderson, and the flight attendant, Mucklow. Now, Mucklow, obviously, Schaffner, she got off. She didn't have to stick around there. There's a new flight attendant, Mucklow. And Cooper actually says to her, bugger off, mate. You head up into the cockpit, right? As soon as we're in the air, you head up into the cockpit and lock the door there and add, because I'm not interested in you being in the cabin while I'm, you know, taking care of things down here. So sure enough, Mucklow goes off. And this leaves Cooper alone there in the cabin by himself. And about 20 minutes later, obviously we don't know exactly what Cooper did, but about 20 minutes later, the four people in the cockpit, they report a warning light flashing to say that the back staircase has been lowered. So they know that the back door has been opened and the staircase has been lowered in midair, let's not forget. Now, obviously, you can figure out what's going on, back at the tail end of the plane. And at 8:13 p.m., there's a slight lift at the back of the plane's tail as Cooper presumably chucks himself out of the plane with the cash strapped to him. Now, 2 hours later, they don't exit the cockpit because, again, they don't want anything to go wrong, so they don't leave the cockpit for the entire flight. 2 hours later, the plane lands in Reno safely. They've stayed in the cockpit for the entire duration of the flight, and armed cops, they storm the plane as soon as it lands, but sure enough, Cooper's not there, he's buggered off, and he's left behind his tie, the little tie pin, and two of the parachutes. Everything else, the sunnies, the cash, and the bomb, all gone. So after this bloke has chucked himself out of the plane with, today's equivalent of over $1 million in cash, the FBI, I tell you what, they get their asses into top gear straight away to try to sort all this rubbish out by investigating a fair few different avenues, it has to be said, because they didn't have a lot to go on, but what they did have, as leads, they took very seriously and sort of hunted down as quickly as possible. The first thing they tried to do was find exactly where this bloke landed, and if he even survived skydiving out into, I didn't mention this, sorry, wasn't the most pleasant weather outside of the plane. Cooper jumped out into wind chill that was nearly 60 degrees Celsius below zero in a bloody Dimmies and Forges suit. He's got a thin old bag of fruit on, doesn't have a winter coat, doesn't have his gloves or anything else like that. So he's going to be a very chilly boy. But they can't actually determine where he might have landed, whether he was dead or alive when he landed. They can't determine because of a few different reasons. There are a few things that sort of mess with their calculations here. Firstly, the flight path of the aeroplane was sort of messed up by these strong winds, these winds that were blowing it all here, there and everywhere. In addition to that, the slow flying speed and the very poor visibility meant that the pilots had a very hard time determining exactly where they were when Cooper jumped out. So that's the first thing. And secondly, depending on how long Cooper waited before pulling the ripcord, he actually basically could have been anywhere because for anyone who's played PUBG, you'll know, very, very different story depending on when you pull that old ripcord. If you don't get it exactly right, you think you're heading to the military base and all of a sudden you're being shot to death in Pachinki. So, you've got to be very careful about that. And because they didn't know when he pulled the ripcord, how far above the ground he was, how far he floated, how far the wind blew him, huge area that they had to search here for, just any kind of clue. Because, of course, as I say, they didn't know if he survived. And if he survived, it's not as if he would have set up a cabin in the, in the Washingtonian woods to live there with, $200,000 as firewood. Anyway. So they searched and searched and searched this whole area south of around Mount St. Helens and near the Lewis River, which they decided were the most likely spots, but they didn't find a lick of evidence. They didn't find a single thing. They didn't find Cooper or any of the stuff that he had on him, and they didn't find the parachute. So they just absolutely came up stone cold blankskis there. In the spring of 1972, so about 4 or 5 months after this whole thing happens, the FBI and a bunch of blokes from the Army, they search again for 5 weeks, after the winter, of course. They search again for 5 weeks, but still couldn't find anything. So there are two massive searches organised that don't turn up a single goddamn thing. They actually even, if you believe this, they actually even used a submarine to search the bottom of a nearby lake, Lake Merwin, and they still couldn't find anything. So they really didn't, they didn't really went at it, like a bull at a gate trying to find absolutely anything at all. The search effort was actually one of the biggest in the history of the United States, and the fact that it was a total failure really didn't get the ball rolling in a particularly positive way. Anyway, secondly, apart from the search efforts, they actually tried to track down the cache. This was the other thing that they tried to do. A couple of other things, but this is one of the other things they tried to do. They tried to track down the cache. The FBI, they distribute the serial numbers. You remember, they took photos of all of the banknotes. So they distribute all the serial numbers of the banknotes that were given to Cooper, and they kept an eye on casinos and banks and other places that deal with, you know, huge amounts, large amounts of cash money, things like, you know, greyhound tracks, horse races, that sort of thing. Anywhere where, you know, a large amount of money is less, a large amount of cash is less likely to raise eyebrows. The FBI keeping a close watch on all that sort of thing to see if any of the serial numbers pop up. Now, nothing ever turns up. A few people bring in, you know, one or two notes here or there with similar serial numbers, but none of the original money is found. It's incredible. It's like it just disappears entirely. It's never found, never spent, and never turns up. It's quite amazing. In addition to obviously the FBI's effort, Northwest Orient actually offered a reward of 15% for the return of the cash. But they've actually got nothing to worry about. You know, as sort of a princely sum as you think that is, they've actually got nothing to worry about because the insurer, they're obviously insured for this sort of thing, and the insurer pays back $180,000 of the $200,000 that is stolen. So, you know, they're golden. Don't even worry about that. Now, the third thing that the authorities do is they chase up a bunch of suspects that they have, but none of these ever eventuate into anything much at all. Now, one of the reasons I want to talk about, one of the reasons we call this bloke DB Cooper rather than Dan Cooper, which was obviously the name that he gave when he checked in, it's because the first guy that was interviewed by the FBI, his name was DB Cooper. So obviously, you know, a little bit of a similarity there. And some absolute idiot journalist, he cocks it up beyond belief here. And when reporting on the issue, the whole incident, he actually reports the suspect's name as being officially DB Cooper. So that's why that name kind of stuck rather than Dan Cooper. But they interview this DB Cooper, and nothing comes of that interview, but that's where the name comes from. They investigated other people as well, including one bloke whose brother dobbed him in. His brother called him up and said, "Listen, I think my brother's actually done this," because this is actually kind of getting pretty dark, because his brother had murdered his entire family 2 weeks before the hijacking, and he had completely disappeared. And so when his brother saw this news report, he goes, "Oh, I reckon it was that bastard brother of mine," and they reported, you know, obviously very sad tale there, but that one didn't sort of eventuate in anything either. And quite interestingly, actually, quite a number of people actually claimed to be this DB Cooper fellow in later years. So, you know, as we moved further and further away from the crime itself, quite a number of people actually came forward and said, "Yep, it's me. You know, I did it. Yep." It's like at the end of The Commuter, how they're all saying that they are, what's the name? Man, that film was so bad. I can't even remember the name of the person they were hunting for. Kenner? I think it was a K. I don't remember. Don't watch it. If you're ever flying like with KLM and you're thinking, "Oh yeah, I'll just pass the time, watch a decent film," don't watch The Commuter. Even Liam Neeson can't save that film. Anyway, all these people, they come forward. Spartacus was probably just a much better example of everyone coming forward and claiming to be one person, to be honest. I don't know why I went for some C-grade action thriller flick that Liam Neeson, you know, was foolish enough to get himself tricked into. Anyway, bunch of people come forward. "I'm DB Cooper," they say. Lots of prison inmates do this after they've been convicted of other stuff. They say, "Oh, also did the hijacking, don't worry about that." And also, include this one's great, a bloke whose wife said that he talked about the hijacking in his sleep. So that was enough to convince him to try to confess for it. Anyway, the best one, however, the best of the bunch here was actually a transsexual woman named Barbara Dayton, who said that she had hijacked the plane in order to get back at the Federal Aviation Administration for denying her a pilot's license. Now, that I would have to say, I mean, look, you know, full power to this person for fighting for the rights of, you know, of transsexual people around the world, and good on her for getting off to a head start in that in 1971. I would say, however, for those anyone who was attempting to right the wrongs of the world, in this situation, two wrongs don't make a right. Don't go and hijack a plane if you're unhappy about that sort of thing. It's not the best course of action. I don't want to tell you how to run your business, but I wouldn't suggest that as your sort of plan A. Anyway, she actually later takes back the confession anyway, when she finds out that as a result of her confession, the FBI could still charge her for it. You know, so she comes out bragging, "Oh yeah, you know, did it to stick one up the FAA," and then the FBI, "Oh, did you really? Okay, well, how about, you know, a lifetime behind bars?" She's like, "I actually didn't. Just jokes. Didn't mean it." So Unfortunately for the FBI, there really isn't much, there's not much grass on the wicket when it comes to trying to find the culprit, the actual person who committed this crime here. The best lead they actually get, funnily enough, it comes almost 10 years later. So we're a decade on now, into the 80s, so 1980. When some new evidence emerges, but it actually really messes up all the theories, the working theories that they'd had at the time. It's because of what, I'll tell you what happens. Basically, there's a kid, right? This kid, his name is Brian Ingram. He's 8 years old at the time in 1980, and he's mucking about in the sand of the Columbia River. While he's doing this, he finds three packets of the cash that was given to Cooper, still in their rubber bands, although, you know, pretty messed up after years in the wilderness and, you know, particularly near a river. One of the packets is missing 10 of the notes, so it's almost three full packets of this money that was given. Where they were found meant that Cooper wouldn't have landed in the area that had been searched back in 1972. So despite that they searched all this area, it was actually found outside the search zone. So if he'd landed in that area, they would have missed him completely. Oops, sort of a bit of a stumble on that one there, old FBI. But the problems that arose from this discovery were huge here, because first of all, why were there 10 notes missing? Why hadn't the rubber bands deteriorated further? Why did all three packets stay together after years of travelling, presumably near a river, maybe in the river at some point? How had they all stuck together? There were all these problems, and obviously, you know, people in the grand tradition of Sherlock Holmes are trying to twist the theories to suit the facts rather than the facts to suit the theories, but the theories are getting bloody sillier and sillier until one bloke says, check this out, one bloke suggests that it was a wild animal that had picked up the packets somewhere and then buried them where Ingram had found them. So there's some moose in the Northwest Pacific that's like, oh yeah, well, good, couple of, you know, nice little nest egg for me. Here, I'll go and bury that and hope that some 8-year-old kid doesn't find it. So they really don't know what's going on here. The most ridiculous part here was poor old Brian, poor old Boz, this little kid, right? He misses out on his treasure trove. It actually takes until 1986 for the money to be returned to him. So he finds his money, he hands it in like a good chap, and he doesn't get it back. So imagine this as a kid, you come across all this money, you think, oh, this is, I mean, imagine how many bloody Mars bars and jelly beans you're going to get at the milk bar that night. But no, he hands it in, does the right thing, and then 6 years later he doesn't even get all the money returned to him. It's ridiculous. He only gets less than half of what he actually found, right? And then the FBI also take 14 of the notes for evidence, and the rest was split between Ingram and the insurance company. So, you know, it's an absolute travesty here. Really an injustice of the bloody greatest magnitude, you would say. Anyway, actually, you know, I'm hesitant to say it's a huge injustice, because Brian Ingram actually, he did all right out of it. So he managed to sell 15 of the notes for $37,000 later on. So, you know, he's selling $20 notes for, you know, a grand total of, he's selling 15 of them for $37,000. So he actually did too bad at it. So yeah, don't complain, Brian. You actually did all right. There were no other major leads. Even since that time, all the way through to today in 2018, there hasn't been a single fresh piece of evidence to suggest that any developments have been made here. People have recorded fingerprints and DNA evidence. And in January last year, in January 2017, actually, a bunch of these bloody nerdy chemists, they announced that Cooper's tie had traces of cerium and strontium sulfide in it. So good to know, I guess. Great that, you know, they're still on the case and trying to crack it. You know, that these critical breakthroughs are still being made. Anyway, ultimately today, we still don't know. We hardly know anything about D.B. Cooper. We don't know who he is. We don't know where he came from, how old he is, what he's doing. Nothing. No, nothing about his background, nothing about where he is now. I think Randall Munro, the author of XKCD, once suggested that it may actually be Tommy Wiseau. That may actually explain where he got all the money to fund, you know, the room and all the other crazy stuff that he did. But what we do know about D.B. Cooper is he's bloody clever. He was a clever cookie, I'll tell you this one. He planned this crime perfectly. So first of all, he picked the day before Thanksgiving weekend, as he knew that people would be busy with family stuff all weekend. It means that there'd be extra days before the cops were back behind their desks to investigate, right? So that's number one. It also gave him a bunch of extra time to get out of the area and maybe go back to work on Monday, seeing as he's got the old four-day weekend, you know, without being missed. He also chose a flight that was on a 727 because it was the model of aeroplane that had a rear stairway, which is the most suitable for skydiving. Obviously, jumping out the side of a plane, very, very dangerous compared to jumping out the back of it, especially when you've got, you know, big turbines or propellers or jet engines or whatever's going on with these ones. And on top of that, he asked four parachutes to make the authorities think that he was going to force someone to jump out with him. So he actually, by asking for four, obviously you have one and then a backup, so you only need two per person. By asking for four, he planted in their minds the idea that he was actually going to take someone with him and continue to hold them hostage. But interestingly, with the parachutes, he actually wasn't that smart with them because he picked the worst parachutes that had been included, and he also he picked a dummy chute that was clearly marked dummy. It was included as a mistake, and he picked that. Despite it being clearly marked, he picked that as his backup. So he obviously either very, very confident or very, very foolish indeed. The FBI later said that they'd actually given him this dummy parachute by mistake, but, you know, who knows. Anyway, in any case, this bloke, he got away with it. Absolutely got away with it one way or another. And today it remains, check this out, it remains the only unsolved case of air piracy in history. It is the only case of this sort of crime happening like this and never being solved or never being resolved. It is still to this day a mystery what happened. Now, as a result, I have to say there's a sort of a nasty twist in the tale here that we can all blame DB Cooper for here, because as a result of this crime, airport security started to get jacked up enormously, because after this, there were a bunch of copycat hijackings. There were 31 hijackings the next year in 1972 in the United States. And at this point, the FAA is like, I've had enough of this. And the FAA mandate bag searches in 1973. So that was when it all kicked off. You know, you couldn't just take whatever luggage you wanted onto a plane anymore. You had to have your bag searched or bag checked before you went on. Now, also, they changed the design of the 727 as a result to make it impossible to open the rear stairs from outside the cockpit. A smart move, I would say. I don't know why you'd ever need to open the stairs without having access to the cockpit. And all the cockpit doors, this is when they had peepholes installed in them. So you could, if you were in the cockpit, you could still see it out to the cabin to check what was going on. But anyway, no matter all of this other stuff that we've mentioned, at the end of the day, DB Cooper, the absolute perfect crime, $200,000 in his back pocket, jumping out of a plane, laughing himself to death, having a great time, getting away with it, the perfect crime. But that's it. That's all she wrote today, sports fans. That is the story of the air pirate DB Cooper and how he sailed to freedom with 200,000... Well, actually, not really sailed, did he? Parachuted to freedom is a better way of putting that one there. Anyway, he did that. Couple of little things to leave you with before we close out the show, of course. I don't know if I mentioned this. I've got a Twitter account. We've got Half-Assed History is on Twitter. You can jump on Twitter, search Half-Assed History, and you will find the account there. And I tend to just, I try to tweet every day just little things that I come across in my research and in the reading that I'm doing, whatever else. So, yeah, you'll find little tidbits, little facts and that sort of stuff from, from the world of history there if you want to follow the show. The other thing as well is I've set up a Patreon account. Now, this is... I describe myself as an optimistic person, and I describe this as an optimistic move. I'm not expecting, you know, a deluge of gold to land in my lap here, but a couple of people have asked me about it, so I thought it was worth setting up there. The benefits are a little iffy at this stage. I'll see if I can iron them out a little bit to, you know, make them a little bit more convincing. Well, we'll see. Anyway, it's a work in progress, but if you want to chuck me a buck or two per episode, geez, I bloody love it. And yeah, you can do that by going to halfasthistory.net, and you can find all the links there to the Twitter, to the Patreon, to old episodes, that sort of thing. Final thing, very exciting thing, is I have got stickers to send to anyone who is interested in getting them. If you would like some stickers, I will send them your way absolutely free of charge. All you need to do is send me an email, halfasthistory@gmail.com, with your address, and I'll send them to you. Don't even worry about it. I'll cover the postage because, of course, you know, all those Patreon dollars that will be coming in will be more than sufficient for that. There is nothing else I need to say, so that is that. Didn't really think about that sentence before I started it, so, yep, needed a better run-up. Anyway, leaving you this week, as I do every week, with a thought that was posted on Reddit. Reddit historian Jay Vulture had a question for us to think about this week. Obviously, we talked about the piloting skills of the one of the pilots there, William... I've forgotten his name already, doesn't matter. The question posed by Jay Vulture, you know, as we've been talking about skilled pilots, why was it that kamikaze pilots, obviously, you know, some of the most skilled pilots you would presume in the Japanese Air Force, why did they fly their planes so badly?